man by the name of Robert Wells wrote a children's book in an attempt to help children understand the, or at least begin to understand the enormity of what is the universe. He titled his book, "Is the Blue Whale the Biggest Thing That There Is?" He mentions that this blue whale is so large that the flippers on the end of his tail are actually larger than most any other animal on planet Earth. But then he compares the blue whale to a mountain. And he said, if you could take a jar big enough to hold 1,000 blue whales inside that jar, you could hollow out Mount Everest and put over 1 million of those jars inside that mountain. He continues to make his point by comparing the mountain to planet Earth. And he says, you could take and stack 100 Mount Everests on top of one another, and it would just be a whisker on the face of planet Earth. He then compares planet Earth to the sun. And he says that you could fit 1 million planet Earths inside of the sun. He then speaks of the giant red superstar Antares. And he says you can fit 50 million suns onto that one star, Antares. But Antares isn't nearly as large as the Milky Way galaxy. And he says then that the Milky Way galaxy isn't nearly as large as the universe, including that these words, that billions and billions of other galaxies are found in the universe. So again, his point is to try to open the minds of children to begin to grasp just how large is this thing we call the universe. And indeed, it's not just children that can't get their minds around the size of the universe. We adults find this mind-boggling as well, that God simply, I say simply, spoke this entire thing, spoke it into existence. Now, I share these kinds of thoughts with you because I think that King David must have been entertaining these types of contemplations as we read in Psalm 8, verses 3 through 6. He says, O God, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have ordained, when I stop and begin to realize just what it is that you created, you get the picture that he begins to just get overwhelmed at these kinds of thoughts. But then he makes a very important transition in his thoughts and words when he says, what is it about man? God, you created all of this, and yet you are hyper-focused upon man. What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you visit or care about him. You've made him a little lower than the angels, and you've crowned him with glory and honor, and you have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. David says, God, despite the overwhelming nature, the incredible vastness of all that you created, known as the universe, why is it that mankind is your crowning jewel? Why do you consider mankind to be your highest accomplishment, your masterpiece in the brush of creation? Well, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to follow David's thinking. And we're going to try to grasp this concept that he puts before us. Despite all that is overwhelming in the nature and creation of God, why is it? And what is it about us, oh God, that you have made the center point of all that there is? The next couple of weeks, we're going to be in Psalm 139. And we're going to follow this outline as we, again, attempt to get a grip on why God has stationed us in the middle of all his creation, and why we are the center point, the crowning jewel, his masterpiece. In Psalm 139, over the next 2 weeks, we'll follow this outline. Point one is that God knows us intimately, verses 1 through 6. Point two is that God sees us individually, verses 7 through 12. Point three, that God created us intentionally, verses 13 through 16. And point four, that God loves us immeasurably, verses 17 and 18. Let me just add this. In these next two messages, we are following our overall series on the benefits of being born again. But today, and then especially next Sunday, try not to miss. I'm excited about this morning, but next Sunday morning can awaken you to a reality that can be a tremendous gift for you. Psalm 139. David begins this very important writing by communicating this fact that despite all that he created, he's placed man in the center, and he wants us to know this truth, that he knows everything about us, that he knows us intimately, he knows us at the core of our being. David wants us to realize that without a doubt, as we begin the exposition of this passage, that we have to realize that we are an open book before the Lord God. He says it this way in verse 1, Lord, you have searched me and you know me. That term search in the Hebrew means to puncture and to spread. The idea is to dig up and expose. It is uncovering the surface to reveal that which is under, to expose that which is real, that which is true, the essence, the heart, to search. He is not fooled by our fake smiles, by our plastic faces, by our uncomfortable laughs. God is not fooled by the defense mechanisms that we use to try to make other people unaware of what's really going on inside. God is not duped even by the things we do to trick ourselves, to make ourselves believe that we're not really that we really didn't mean to do that, to soften the sinfulness of our heart, to just take glances at the selfishness by which we demand in relationships. God searches, and thereby he goes beyond the surface, and he sees and he knows the truth, the reality of our core essence, our core being. It's almost as if God is doing a living autopsy on us. He sees and knows. Not only though does he know our core being, verse 2 says he knows our contemplations, our thoughts. He says, you know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thoughts afar off. David is just reminding us that there's no hiding from him. Even our most secret thoughts, those that we would never dare give verbalization to, those things that we entertain that we've never ever said out loud, we've never told a living soul, and we would die before anybody knew that we were thinking these thoughts, that we were entertaining these thoughts. We would be so ashamed if anybody found out. We literally would want to die before people knew that we entertain those thoughts. And yet, our thoughts are exposed to the sight of God. In fact, the original writing here suggests this, that our thoughts are like broadcast in a digital way. It's like our thoughts are on a screen like this before Holy God. And that is, even before we think them, God knows that which we entertain, that we would die before anybody knew. Not only our core being, not only our contemplations, but our conduct. Verse 3, David continues this revelatory insight of God when he says, "In God you comprehend my path. Am I lying down? You're acquainted with all my ways." How many times have you been watching the news or podcast, and the reporter is talking about an individual who has committed a heinous crime, multiple murders, and they found him out through DNA evidence. And the guy lives on a middle-class street, a middle-class neighborhood. He's got a wife and three kids. He works a job that he's been at for 15 years, and he is neighborly to those around him. He loans his tools, and those that he receives, he gives back. And when the news reporter interviews his neighbors and friends and maybe even his family, you hear this consistent theme. "I just can't believe this. That's not who he is. I've known him for X number of years, and he is a good guy. It is not in his character to do something like that. I would never have believed this, except they've got DNA evidence. This just doesn't make sense, because this is not him." Well, what we know is that we don't know each other, and we don't even know how deceivingly wicked is our own heart. We don't know what our neighbors do in the darkness of night. We don't know what each other is capable of. But this passage says, "God, you know my path." That is, wherever I go. "You know my lying down." "And you are acquainted." That is, you are intimately aware of all my ways. God doesn't have the blindness that we have with each other. We can't see thoughts. We can't read intents. We don't know contemplations. And we don't see when we are away. But God says, or David says, "God, like Santa Claus, knows our lying down and getting up. And he knows all our ways. God will never be surprised. God will never be caught off guard. He knows all things, all my ways. Not only my conduct, but my conversations. To make sure David has covered every area in verse 4, he says, "For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it all together." Not a word on my tongue, but God, you already know what it is. It truly is. Think about this. It truly is overwhelming to realize that right now, this very moment, God is listening to perhaps billions of conversations and prayers. Right at this second. That God is listening to billions of people speaking, of people thinking, of people praying in how many different languages? All at the same time. In this moment, and in this moment, and in this moment, he knows every word, precisely every single word. David goes on to identify the same kind of emotions. We have this overwhelming sense of the glory of God. In verses 5 and 6, David says, "You have hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's so high, I cannot attain it." David says, God, in spite of the fact that there are so many other people on this earth, in spite of the fact that you hear all of the words that they speak and all the prayers that they offer in innumerable different languages, despite your love being for all of these billions of people, you point your finger right at me and you hedge me in a protective cocoon. You go in front and behind and to the side. God, how is it that in spite of the vastness of the universe, you crown mankind as your jewel? And how is it that despite there being billions of people on this planet, people that are the most important thing to you, how is it that in spite of all of that, you have your full attention upon me? How is it, God, that you work that way? How is it that you seclude me and you study me? It's more than I can comprehend. These thoughts give us a natural segue into verses 7 through 12, that God sees us individually. Matt, read that for us, please. Verses 7 through 12 of Psalm 139.
Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, Even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to you.
I'm going to make this brief, but this is, please hear closely, because this can set your heart aflame. David is saying, God, what I've realized, in spite of the vastness of the universe, you crown mankind. In spite of there being billions of people, you give unto me all that you are. And I've realized, God, that even wherever I go, you're there. I can't hide from you because you find me. I can't run from you because you follow after me. Wherever I go, you are there because you pursue me. And I want you to focus upon that word pursue, because it describes all of the passages that Matt read. It describes David's ideology and his belief system here. It describes David's heart that is caught up in the fact that wherever he goes, God chases after him. Please catch this. Even in Psalm 23, the 23rd Psalm that is such a favorite for many, verse 6, David wrote, "Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life." Surely, he says, not surely, but surely, goodness from the heart of God and mercy out of his grace. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me. Bad translation, because the word is pursue. Surely goodness, the goodness of God, and mercy, the mercy of his grace, will chase me down. You get that? It will run after me. Picture in your mind the prodigal son. You remember the story. The prodigal son took his inheritance and went to the far country, and he spent it all, and he ended up with the world beating him to a pulp. And all the time that he's gone, his father, who represents God himself, his father goes out and watches for him. His father looks from his porch and other positions, trying to see if today is the day when his prodigal son, his lost son, will come home. And then one of those days, when he was out looking and checking the horizon, that maybe this is the day his son will return, suddenly he sees him. And what does the Bible say he does? He runs. I want you to keep that picture in your mind, because it doesn't matter where you go or what you do. It doesn't matter if you're within the family system, if you are a church family, if you are a sheep that has stayed within the flock. It doesn't matter if you are the prodigal son and you are lost somewhere out in the far country. It doesn't matter if you've turned your back and you are pursuing things of the world and the flesh. Right now, it doesn't matter if you are realizing that you really have sinned against God and that He's calling you home. It doesn't matter where you are, where you've gone. It doesn't matter if you're full of doubt, full of question, if your heart is overwhelmed with grief, if you're angry, upset. It doesn't matter. Because the goodness and the mercy of God is chasing after you. And if you will pause and turn around, that goodness and mercy will slam right into you and hit you right in the heart. I want to close with this last illustration. I promise I'm through. Greg Boyle is the author who wrote a book called Tattoos of the Heart. And in his book, he describes something that occurred to one of his friends, a man named Bill Kane. Bill's father was ill. Bill's father was a godly man, a deacon for years and years and years in his church. Bill's father led his family to church every Sunday, morning, night, Wednesday night. Bill's father lived out a godly life before and with his family. And now Bill's father was filled with cancer and he was dying. So Bill took a break from his ministry to go and be with his father and to care for his dad. And the story is that, if I can find my notes here, the story is, anyway, that Bill would just be exhausted at the end of the day and caring for the needs of his dad. And so at night, he would try to get his dad to go to sleep. And in doing so, he would read stories to his dad, just like his dad read to him. So role reversal. And he's reading stories to his dad, and he's encouraging his dad, "Dad, please close your eyes. Please go to sleep. I'm tired too, but I want to read this to you so that you'll go to sleep." And so his dad would close his eyes for a minute, but Bill said after a few minutes, one would pop open, start looking at him. He'd close, the other one would pop open, and a smile would cross his face. And Bill said it's happened night after night, trying to get my dad to go to sleep, and he just wouldn't. He just kept looking at me and looking at me. And then Bill said this about that experience with his dad. He said, "My dad so loved his son that he just couldn't take his eyes off of him." My dad so loved me. My dad was so proud of me. My dad was so enthralled with me that he couldn't take his eyes off me. Wherever you are, spiritually, emotionally, whatever you've done, whatever you've thought, whatever you think you're hiding, God knows all about it. and his goodness, his mercy, the power of his love is chasing you and trying to nail you right in the heart. It doesn't matter where you go. God will pursue you until you turn around. Because he so loves you, he can't take his eyes off you.